Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of Corporate Quitter. I'm like thrilled to have today's guest on because I'm an artist and person on today is perfect for all my creatives out there looking to basically create something of their art. So her name is Julie Turkel. She's a brand licensing agent, strategy consultant, and overall champion for creative brands. With over 30 years of experience in brand licensing and a unique ability to trend spot rising brands and talent, Julie has taken brands from the seed stage to multi-million dollar lifestyle brands through the licensing or partnership business model. Now, when I saw Julie online, I was like, I need to talk to Julie because for those of you listening who know me well, I'm obsessed with art. And there are a lot of people who are artists as well who are like, how do people get into the Walmarts, the Ikeas, the Targets? Like, is it even worth it? Like, what's the actual lingo behind? Like, I wanted to know everything once I saw your video about brand licensing. So before we get into that, can you give us a little background on like how you even got into this? Because it's super niche, isn't it? Like, at least what
very
you do.
Niche.
Yeah. How did you get into that?
So, okay. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's so much fun to be able to talk to you about this. And I'm surprised that more artists don't really learn about the business of licensing in school or whatever. Or that people don't like share as much information. Like a lot of people in the licensing business, it's actually a huge business. It's like there's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of products that is licensed out there. It's a huge industry. But for whatever reason, a lot of the people who end up in the business kind of fall into it through other ways. Like, you know, somebody who's in advertising ends up in a department at a company and they need him to like figure out how to do licensing. And for me, I came into it when I graduated from college. Like, I was pre-med, so go
Wait,
figure.
Really?
Yeah, I was pre-med.
What a 180. I was going to say 360, but like literally, like, how did you go from being med to create? Like, okay, anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm like, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
I mean, I'll give you a quick backstory. So, you know, I grew up in Tampa, Florida, and where I grew up is like, especially, you know, I'm probably twice the age of most people who are going to be listening to this podcast. So we didn't have the internet. We didn't have like as much exposure to anything. So I really grew up in a very sheltered place where there was not a lot of creativity or a lot of like options as far as career directions were concerned. So my dad was a doctor. All of his friends were doctors. All my uncles were doctors. So when I went to college, I went to Georgetown and like, I was like, okay, I'm going to be pre-med. Like that's really all I knew in terms of career. And I was very ambitious. And I was pre-med and I also was a psychology major and like I studied in college. Like my professors like loved me because I was like a teaching assistant. Like I just like went to college to study. I don't know what I was thinking, but when I was graduating, I knew I didn't want to go to medical school. I knew all along that I didn't want to go to medical school, but I just didn't know what else was possible for me. Mm-hmm. So one of my psychology professors said, why don't you go study with a colleague of mine at Columbia? They're creating a new department called the Communications, Computing, and Technology Department, and they need people to come study so I can hook you up with a scholarship. So I had graduated from Georgetown pre-med and moved straight to New York, enrolled at Columbia, had a scholarship to study something I didn't even know what it was. And this was, at that time, technology-wise, to give you a sense, America Online was the way that you got to the internet, and very few people had it. Like, there was not a lot going on with technology in the world. And so I joined this communications, computing, and technology program, and the classes were at night, and all of my classmates had full-time jobs. And one of them, this is a long story short, but one of them was working at Nickelodeon and created the show Blue's Clues.
No
and
way. Oh, my
so,
God. It's like the basis of my childhood. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my
God. So she was creating it while we were in school together. Like, she went to this graduate program. She worked at Nickelodeon as, like, you know, creator, producer, and was coming up with the theory and the philosophy for Blue's Clues while we were in class. And I was fascinated and obsessed and just was like, that must be the coolest company to work for. So I decided I was going to go work for Nickelodeon. So my career move was like, not like, oh, I want to be this or that. It was like, I just want to work at this specific company. That's where I want to be. So I interviewed with everybody that would take an interview with me in every department at all levels. And I really connected with an executive who was very senior in the licensing or the consumer products division that was making toys and videos and video games
So cool.
and apparel and fruit snacks and all that kind of stuff. And she needed an assistant. And so she basically was like, come work for me for a year as my assistant and then I'll promote you. So that's how I got into licensing, because I was her assistant. I was like her right hand. And then to end this long story, when she promoted me, the person who was running the partnership between Nickelodeon and Mattel, the toy company, which was the biggest source of revenue to my department and to all of Nickelodeon, left. And they needed somebody to fill the position. So they put me in the position, you know, a year in.
That's amazing. What an opportunity. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like the fact that I think it's crazy that even like your colleague who was in that tech department, like how do you even go from tech to being in merchandise, licensing at Nickel? Like, I don't know. It's such a cool series of events. It seems like it was like perfectly aligned for your path, because also to go from Tampa to New York is one major jump. Then from tech to like, it's just so many pivots. But you said, hey, this is what I want to do. And you were on a mission and you did it.
The universe just kind of like put me in these places. Interestingly enough, the graduate program at Columbia was not happy about the position that I took at Nickelodeon. Like they...
But was it like contracting with your... Or was it like interfering with your work? Or
it wasn't. No. Well, it did. Definitely did. Because from that point forward, I would just messenger my papers and my essays or whatever, all my homework, because I had a full-time job. But they also, it was like kind of like anti what they were trying to, like it was like the exploitation of the media. They considered licensing to be kind of like an exploitation, like, you know, preying on people, like kids' connection to these characters and then getting them to buy like, you know, fruit snacks and things that were bad for their teeth or whatever, overconsumption. So they were a little bit opinionated about it, but it was fine because like, that really set me, like, I didn't know, you know, I've been searching for something that I thought was interesting to do and I had no clue. So I, you know, just one thing led to another and it, you know, I've been in the business ever since. So
cool. It's so crazy. And so that basically from there, you started your business and you went straight into that. Is that how basically, like, how did you go from Nickelodeon to then having your own business? Because I think around the market crash is when you started, right? That was the first iteration of the business or no?
September 11th. So I think I was at Nickelodeon for maybe 4 or 5 years in licensing. I left there, ultimately ended up at Discovery Channel. That was also, you know, that's, you know, Discovery Channel, like with the learning shows, whatever. So they were getting into licensing and they had a new division with somebody who was running that division who I really respected in the industry. And they had come up with this idea of creating learning toys for kids based off of the Discovery brand. And they pitched it to Target. And Target decided to go for it. And they gave them like a 38-foot aisle in the store. It was like a whole aisle dedicated to Discovery. And they needed somebody to come in and figure out what toys to put there, like what companies to work with and how to get that serviced and that business going. So I worked there and it was interesting because Target is known for these partnerships they do, the licensing and all these collaborations that they do, but their partnership with Discovery was the second brand they ever did that with.
Huh.
So it was really good experience. I just got very lucky.
So cool. And also like they're all, it's so fun to be in an industry that's newly blooming and like finding their footing in a new space. Like you literally got to like watch it become what the mega conglomerate that it is today, right? Like licensing, I think it's something that like it's just natural, but you literally saw it like being born essentially, right? Basically, kind of sort of.
I've seen it change, actually. What's interesting to me about being in this business is that it's a very traditional old school business. It really has sort of like its roots in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much so like deeply integrated with corporate trademark, like Dr. Scholl's footwear becoming like Dr. Scholl's like corn remover pads, like things like that, like super boring, traditional corporate, like a lot of the big businesses that have huge licensing businesses that are the cornerstone of the industry are very, very corporate and not really to my liking. But at the time when I started the business, it was definitely like that. But by the time I decided to start doing something on my own, there were some interesting applications that were percolating. Not to say that artists didn't always have licensing as part of their, you know, an opportunity for them. Not to say that there weren't a lot of creative ways in which companies were partnering with other companies. But in terms of like how the licensing business operated, everything kind of fit squarely into a box. Like you were a corporate trademark, you were a character brand, a sports team or maybe a nonprofit and maybe an artist, but what about a designer brand? Like, where did that fit? So when I decided to leave corporate, I really wanted to go after a niche that was like not a fashion brand, but not an artist, somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
And that was like pre-influencer. So now you're like, business must be booming because it's so perfectly timed with the way that like people are leaving corporate. They're like, I want to be a creator. I want to be a business owner. Like, I don't want to play this game. I want to be a fractional worker, like anything but the traditional I'm here for. I guess one of the things that we had talked about at one point was like, you had said, I don't know how so many people don't know about licensing, but right, my brain as both an artist and a creator is like, well, it must be expensive and it must require lawyers and it must do all these iterations of this and that. And like, even like I think in one of your videos, you talked about this like cow that everyone sees in IKEA. It's in every store in IKEA, every location. And really what it boils down to is someone took a picture of a bull or, you know, cow and basically pitched it to IKEA like, hey, if you want licensing for this, you can have it and basically run with it. Or every other generic like live, laugh, love sign that's in Walmart. Like the fact that that seems attainable without corporate money, it, to me, is just like, I don't even see it as being attainable, but what you're saying, it basically is like, it's not nearly as hard as it used to be because the box is changing, or it's still the same, like pushed in that those sort of avenues.
So to answer your specific question about the wall decor example, and it was a video I did on TikTok that a lot of people responded to where somebody was showing like walking down the aisle of Target and saying like, does this cow get a royalty? It's all over the place. Wall decor is a very interesting opportunity for artists. And a lot of the companies that manufacture wall decor are art licensing agencies. And the reason for that is that they were like manufacturers of wall decor. They are 100% dependent on having fresh art and like discovering the trends and going into these retailers and showing them, you know, whether it's the fat chef that was like part of my era or it's the cow or there's this cat that's becoming.
Oh my God, the fat chef. I totally forgot, like, the Italian baker. Like, I completely forgot. I mean, I'm not in the industry, so I don't even realize they're trends, but they are. Or, like, what is it? Who was that woman? Emma Dunn? No. Ray Dunn or something? Like, that
yes, Ray Dunn.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, well, that's a whole other story. But, like, the live, laugh, love, or just, like, those, like, motivational signs or whatever it is, there are these publishing companies. They're wall decor publishing companies, and that is their main business. And so, as their main business, they're responsibility or their the way they operate is that they contract with a lot of different artists. So they would either have people on their staff or different artists that they would discover at like craft fairs or wherever, and or stationery, you know, the stationery world or whatever. And they realized that once they had created wall decor with all these artists, that the retailers that they were selling to wanted the art that they were showing them on other products like plates and paper napkins and placemats and, you know, bedding. So they became licensing agents. And so there is a pretty stable set of like the biggest agents in actual art licensing space call themselves publishers because they publish wall decor and that's how they discover. So that's part of their business. But then they kind of help the artist, like select artists that they work with to like become bigger. So it's actually not a new thing. It's like a very old school thing. But what's happening now is that all of these consumer brands and young brands are realizing that like partnering up together is like a great way to kind of amplify your message and gain more followers and like, you know, build exposure. And so it feels very new because of the way in which companies are working with licensing today, but it's rooted and has some very, very traditional old school roots. And it's been very interesting to go back to kind of like your original question of like, me being part of something that was like so big or like that's just doing so much these days. It's like I've watched it really evolve and change. And I guess if I could say one of the things that I really like about what I've been able to do in this business is sort of like adapt to the changes and like always find a way to kind of embrace what is changing about it, which is the reason why I talk about it on TikTok, because that's part of embracing the change is like sharing about it and providing that kind of knowledge and showing people where to find ways to get into it. So, yeah.
I don't even have a pickup on like what actually happened back then. You're obviously giving me examples, but I think about now Like, it's so second nature for me, especially as an artist, because I print my own prints and stuff like that, too. It's like, I'll go to, like, a Printly, a Printful. I'll go to even, like, a Spoonflower, which are these, like, printers or publishers of your art. But it's not necessarily licensing, right? Like, there's a whole nother process with that. And then there's a process of, like, just finding a publisher to then broker deals with bigger brands to actually put stuff on shelf, right? There's, like, three different, I guess there's multiple avenues, but, right? That's, like, it's all different.
Yes and no. So those platforms that you're talking about are things that were started after, you know, I explained to you that when I started my career, America Online was like, you know, we'd have to sit and wait until we had the bandwidth to get on, you know, just like the whole, you could wait like 30 minutes before you got online. And once you got there, couldn't really go anywhere. So technology has changed a lot since I got into this business. And so this platform started. And the people that I know in my industry who've been in it for a while probably like didn't realize like what was really happening. But with, you know, Society6 and Spoonflower, they are technically licensing companies. Yeah. I mean, essentially, I don't know if you read, like when you upload your work to those platforms, you probably don't read the fine print, but somewhere in that fine print, they're basically saying you're giving them the right to reproduce your artwork on their products and they will ship it. And technically, legally, that's the definition of licensing, is when you grant another party the right to use your intellectual property. And your intellectual property is either, you know, it could be your trademark, like a name you've trademarked, your logo, or it could just be your artwork. So you have to legally grant them the right to do it. So it is a form of licensing. It's just not... It's a tedious way to scale your licensing business is to, you know, some people have really cracked the code on those platforms and have figured out like how to do the keyword search and how to like build a huge presence on them. I've dabbled in it a little bit and I've never found it to be that, I never found it to be all that successful, but it's an interesting way because if you're on those platforms, there are companies like the companies that I work with that sell to mass retailers, like whether it's a puzzle company or a card company or, you know, a calendar company or wall decor or whatever. Like there are companies like that that go on the platforms that look for new art and new ideas. And a lot of artists that I've met through the years have gotten their first real licensing deal after being discovered on one of those platforms. So I do think that there are benefits to doing it, even though it's tedious and even though like it's hard to make that your true, you know, core business and day job.
So what is the deal with brand licensing? Like if you were to go the traditional path, right? Kind of what you're talking with about like working with a larger company, giving them the rights, they broker those deals with like the Targets and the Kohl's and the whatever else. And then also like, can you give a little bit of breakdown or insight into like those royalties? Cause like my thought process, whenever I see those pictures, I'm like, great, they get mass produced. Everyone gets to see them. And that's great in the sense of like, you're now everywhere, but then you kind of lose this luster of like, oh, you are the artist. Like, and also there's the concept of like one of one, right? Like only select people get to access this art and now everyone does. There must be like, if there's a positive of making royalties off something that's mass produced and multiple people buy it, but does it take away the value? Like, do you actually make money from it? So can you give us a little bit of like the realness behind it, both pros and cons, I guess you could say?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of questions wrapped into that one
sorry,
question.
Sorry,
it's interesting because when it comes to artists, so I describe myself as a brand licensing agent because I focused on brands and I work with creative brands, including artists, but I take a brand licensing approach. And I'm going to explain a little bit of your answer to your question. I'm going to explain a little bit as I answer this question because
perfect.
There's a big part of the art licensing business, very like old school art licensing, I think has this nature of it that you're kind of describing where a company comes to you and they make scarves or ties or wall decor or whatever. And they're like, can you give me the rights to use these two pieces of artwork on this product? And like artists get very excited about it and they're like, okay, great. And sometimes with those companies, they'll just pay you a fee. They'll say, you know, I'll pay you $250 or $500 per piece of art. You give me the rights to create this product and, you know, and that's it. Sometimes if it's going to a major retailer, they might say, I'll give you 5% of wholesale sales and they'll report it, you know, every 3 months, every quarter. And your name doesn't go on the product. You probably don't even really know, have a lot of control over where it's going. And it just kind of gets into the marketplace. And if you can get it into a huge mass retailer like the Cow at Hobby Lobby and Target, whatever, that can add up to, you know, I would say tens and thousands of dollars every quarter for an item like wall decor, probably, you know, good $10,000, $20,000 every quarter. You know, if you're at a big retailer and it's consistent throughout the year, you could end up with a nice passive income from, you know, from just that one piece. If you get royalties, if you sell it for a flat fee, you miss out on the upside and the royalties. You can build up a great portfolio of doing like this print here and this item there and this thing goes here and this could, and it's hard to kind of call it your own brand when you do it that way, because your name's never going on the package and it's never usually not sold with, you know, 10, like a collection of items around it. So the approach that I take to licensing is a brand licensing approach where when I license an artist that I'm representing to, like I license them to a manufacturer, they have the right and somewhat the obligation to license a whole bunch of things that are in the library, put their brand name on it, and have it sit on the shelf together as a collection. So the artist gets that kind of branding recognition. And if you can build that over time, you can start to ask for higher and higher fees and royalties. And it could really, if you're in the mass market, it could add up to six figures every quarter in passive and like real passive income, like passive in the sense that once you've set it up and you know, you may be creating new prints and dropping them into a Dropbox folder or recommending prints and colorways and things like that. But, you know, that's all you're doing is you're making your digital files accessible and somebody else is going out and creating a world off of it. And it takes some time and takes some, and you know, you asked a little bit about the investment, the upfront investment, and how do you get to that place where you really are building something meaningful. Sometimes it's luck of the draw, but a lot of times it also has to do with how you approach building your portfolio and your pitching and your presentations. And if you've clearly identified a niche for yourself and you've made it like, I'll give you a tangible example. One of the brands that I've been representing for the past 13, I think it's almost 14 years, is a stationery designer named Dabney Lee Woglong. That's her name. She had triplets. She had a stationery line. I discovered her at a stationery show. She had a lot of art, you know, it's just like a lot of her prints looked very cohesive. It was branded in this really cute way named Dabney Lee. Like her logo looked great. She had these big binders out that just like everything felt very packaged well to me. And I was like, oh, I can sell this. So we went out and we licensed planners and sold them at Target. Like we found a company that sold to Target and they sold this whole like end cap of like calendars and planners at Target. And then I showed it to like a tech accessories company and they were like, oh my God, I love the way this is packaged. They created this whole world. Like now we've done like, we have like maybe 10 licensees. And each one of them takes it and like almost like the way that process has worked, everybody sort of bought into this idea that like her brand is like a catch-all for like modern, happy, preppy prints. And they will come to her and say, can you create a donut print? Can you create a black and white theme? Can you create a, you know, thing on bows? Can you create something like, do you have anything about paisley? And like, it's become kind of like this catch-all for that kind of design to the point where the partners are actually like setting the design direction and kind of taking it to the next level. It's become far bigger than either one of us ever thought when we started working together. Even though I thought there was a lot of potential, I didn't see that you'd be able to walk in TJ Maxx and see like cuticle cutters and tweezers and, you know, spa products and travel accessories and home decor and stationery, all with featuring her art. It's just, she's packaged it in a very clever way. And that's the way in which I like to approach, like, I will only work with somebody that I feel like has that potential. Mm-hmm. And when people come to me for portfolio reviews or whatever, I look at everything from that perspective. So
interesting. There's so much, it's so much more complex than I thought it would be, in like a good way, in the sense of like, there's so much that you can do with it. And also there are so many like side doors and back doors and this and that. Like, you're not just confined to like, you only have to do it this one way and you can only create these products and only have this relationship with that brand. Like, to see also that the bigger brands are willing to go both ways and like ask of the artist and the art, like, I don't know, it seems like a nice, fun approach. I mean, obviously they built rapport over the years, both you, her, and the brand, but like, I don't know, it gives me a little bit of hope of like, okay, there's a lot that could be happened with this in a good way. And also, again, I don't think like this, I'm not even thinking tweezers and this and that. I'm thinking of just like the basic things of like a tote bag, you know? But
yeah.
Now, when, let's say, okay, I'm like, okay, I have this cool print. I have this, again, this package, whatever else. What would be like the, I don't want to say all the steps, but like, what can people expect with the licensing process? Like, okay, this is, you know, this is how much the upfront costs usually run. This is the timeline. Like, is this something that can happen in a month? Is it like trademarking where it takes a year? Like, how does this usually work? Just ballpark.
Yeah. So
I know it varies, you know, obviously, but
it kind of does. I feel like the first thing you need to decide, you need to set up your portfolio and or your presentation. And a lot of the artists that I work with, I do some coaching one-on-one, and I have a group, you know, concept that people that I'm coaching. And it's interesting how many artists, like, they don't they don't know exactly how much time they need to create enough art to be able to license. And so in some people are better, like when I met Dabney Lee, it felt like everything was all there. And I've noticed some other artists like struggle more with like building out their library and their portfolio. So that is not like an upfront cost. It's time, you know, insofar that I consider my time to be valuable and worth money. You know, if your time is worth money, you have to put in that time to create. And that is some of the upfront work that needs to go into getting into licensing. Another, you know, and some artists have more of a knack for really understanding how their work can translate to product than others. So I think some of the upfront time that you need to spend is not only in creating a great presentation, having a great portfolio, and having enough well-rounded art to put in it, to show when you're pitching, to have, you know, on your social media and on your website. But I think it's really important to really get to know what other artists and other people or other brands are doing in the space. So I think some of the upfront investment in time is both in creating, but also observing. And I honestly think that the reason why I've done well in this business, because I don't know if it was necessarily like, I didn't study it in college, and I don't know if it would have been something that I would have chosen to do if somebody described certain aspects of it to me. But I think one of the things that makes me staying in this business and relatively good at it is I observe everything. Like there's no detail that gets past me in terms of how I look at other brands and what they're doing. Or when I walk into a store, I can case the joint and like figure out, like I've done videos where I've walked through, I did one the other day where I walked through TJ Maxx and I was like, here are all the places where you could potentially license your art. Like, here are all the different categories. Here's how you find the company. That level of observation and like moxie that it takes to, you know, and discipline that it takes to stick with something like that and to do that. I think a lot of artists get confused or creatives get confused and throw their hands up at it. But it's like some of the upfront investment is really just the time and developing the skills. And it might require the upfront investment might be like, if that's something that you're not naturally inclined to do, or if it's something you seriously want to commit to doing, work with a coach, you know, or work with somebody or take a course or whatever, you know, you can. So let's say you spend somewhere between I would set aside $1,000 at least for just educating yourself on the space, like whether it's getting a course, buying some books, just, you know, whatever. I would just set aside that, but I don't think it's set in stone. You could also find a lot of this stuff for free, but you need to be a sleuth, right?
Yeah.
And then the second investment, you know, the legal investment. If you're an artist, you're not planning on putting your name on the packaging anytime soon, you don't need to trademark and go through that expense yet.
Oh,
but you
okay.
do need to. I would say if that's your plan make sure the trademark is clear, consult with a lawyer and come up with a plan, like, for when you need to do it. I work with a lot of even influencers that are making millions and millions of dollars that didn't file their trademark, and it's not a good thing. But a lot of people like don't want to invest in that, but you at least need to find some professional that can guide you on when is the best time for you to do it and make sure that what you would ultimately want to trademark is clear. But, you know, that can cost you. That process can really cost you at least $1,000. And once you're up and running and you're in a lot of product categories, it could cost, you know, multiples of that to keep things not yearly, but just like from time to time, you need to like set aside some real money to make sure your trademarking process is up to date. The other thing that could cost you money is marketing. You know, nobody's going to discover you if you don't put yourself in some place where people can discover you. And social media is free.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. If you're great with that and you're consistent with that, you can attract opportunities. But for some people, like I described that I found several clients at trade shows.
Well, and Daphne, those were right? Clients, your biggest yeah. client. Like, yeah, she's, yeah, that's, I'm, yeah. that's awesome.
So, you know, but exhibiting at a trade show could cost $5,000, $3,000, $10,000, $20,000, you know, it just depends on which show and how big of a booth. And, you know, there are ways to do it, to cut corners, but you have to know, you don't have to do all of those things. If you can, great, but you have to know where you're comfortable with your marketing, because nobody's just going to come along and find you. And if your pitch isn't landing in the right way, you know, you might have more trouble if you don't have some kind of means for exposure. So yes.
Now you mentioned before, like, oh, influencers who's making millions of dollars off products and things like that. There are some people listening who are like either like rising creators or they're interested in the whole business of it or whatever. I mean, I kind of fall in that category too, but like how much of your personal brand, right? I guess that falls in the marketing category, but does personal brand and you having a presence online versus not play a huge deciding factor when it comes to licensing with big, like big brands, or is it not really? It's more about the art.
When it comes to the traditional side of art licensing, where your brand name isn't going on the package, it doesn't matter at all. And even sometimes with certain retailers, like there are certain retailers that also don't really care that much. But in this day and age, I would say that if all things are equal, like if you're a watercolor artist, you know, your 10 watercolor artists come to the same company or go to the same agent, how would I know which one to sign and which one not to sign, right? Mm-hmm. So you basically, the process of elimination would be like, you have to know what your assets are and how those assets relate to the person that you are approaching, what they want. So some people might say, if you have 300 pieces of art in your library, you're very valuable, as opposed to somebody with, you know, 15,000 followers or 20,000 followers, but like no art in their library. Like somebody's going to find the person with a lot of art more valuable than the person with a lot of followers.
Okay.
These are all things that I teach in my courses or like in my coaching that I focus on that really make a big difference how you position yourself when you're pitching. Because if you don't know how you set yourself apart, no one's going to figure that out on their own if you don't show it to them. So it doesn't mean followers. It doesn't mean having the most money. It doesn't mean having, you know, years and years of experience. If you know of another way to position yourself of value to who you're presenting to. I think the example I gave of somebody who had 300 pieces of art in their library versus somebody with a lot of followers is a good example of that. How you can differentiate yourself without having to spend the money or having all this experience.
Yeah, I just asked because some industries are completely different. Obviously, if you take a publishing, right, being an author, like they want someone who has some sort of following or some interesting story or something of value so that they know when they go to print, there's an ROI. But if like a Target or whatever, like they naturally already have their customers coming in, they know them. Like if they're picking that art, it's probably going to land well. They've done their research. But, you know, I just had to ask. I was curious. The other thing too is, I mean, I would love to keep going into this, but you also do strategy, like you do strategy calls to help people specifically so they can kind of find out like, what's my angle? Like, what should I do? Like, what are the next steps? All of that, right?
Yeah, I do. And it's interesting what comes out in those sessions because there's like a lot of light bulb moments that happen. I think, you know, for me too, like I, just like anybody else, I'm a solo practitioner. I'm in my own bubble at my desk. You know, I think I know everything about my business. And when I go out and I do a pitch, I, you know, can fall into this pattern of like not really examining why maybe certain things that I'm doing aren't landing quite in the way. Like if I'm going out and I'm pitching new clients and people are asking, like aren't getting back to me or not wanting to move forward, it's usually because you have failed to convince that person that what you have to offer is of value to them. Mm-hmm. And it can seem like daunting to try to figure that out, or it can seem like, well, what do you mean? Like, it could seem like, I don't know how to communicate that. It's just is what it is. But when you have another person looking at your business, I bet if I showed you my presentation, you also would probably be like, oh, well, I didn't understand this part of it. Or I didn't, you know, like, oh, I didn't get that point that you made. What point are you trying to make here? we can fall into our own like bubbles and not really understand like how we can improve what we're doing to get better results. So,
oh yeah,
that's knowing, my offer. Yeah,
like not knowing what your secret ingredient is too. Like some people, they don't realize how good they are at certain things. So it's like my friend uses the analogy of like, if you're like a spice jar, like if you are one of the components, one of the spices in the jar, you can't look outside and see the ingredients, right? Because you're within it. So it's probably both things. It's like you probably see this shining light within people and you also see the faults of like, this is why this isn't landing, but you have all these things going for you. So let's just like tweak it and then like go do your thing and like see the magic happens essentially.
Yeah. And a good presentation, which is a lot of what I focus on in my consulting. I mean, I do consult with people also to be like, these are the right categories or these are the partners you should go after. This is the agent that would be a good fit for you or whatever. But a lot of the times it boils down to your pitch. And a lot of creatives fall into this pattern of not being able to describe what differentiates their art. And they use very generic terms like my work is colorful, vibrant, and modern, you know, things that like, or, you know, like
at this point,
things that everybody can describe their work as.
Yes.
How do you, so how, what is, let's dig a little deeper into that. And the more you dig deeper into that and you define it, it becomes a light bulb moment for you because then suddenly it helps you develop new ideas off of it too. You have this like new understanding of what your design is all about. And you not only need it for them, but you need it for yourself. Actually, I've been thinking about it. This has been coming up a lot for me today, that whole topic and that connection between like, you're not just trying to differentiate yourself from other people when you're pitching, but you're also trying to have a guiding light for yourself for what you're doing with your business and your brand and your work and how it's going to build.
Definitely.
And not a lot of people put enough attention into that. And the people that I see being really successful, so it could in some instances, like with Dabney Lee, I think that kind of came naturally to her in a lot of ways. But I, you know, this work, when I work with an artist and we get to that point where we've like gotten past the generic and into something that's super special, like there's just so much that it opens up for them, becomes so much more clear. And their presentations take on a whole new form because you can communicate things verbally. And then when you get really clear on that, you can also communicate those things visually. And that's when things get very exciting. So, yeah.
Probably makes it easier for them to create art too, honestly, because now they know what their like niches and all that. But I'm wondering for people who are listening right now and they're like witnessing the world, like be what it is, which is like an economic disaster and like nothing is. Like, there's so much uncertainty and stuff. Like, one of the really phenomenal things about your story was that you actually were, like, I think you were building a business as the market was crashing, like, right, September 11th, like, things were changing, right? And you've had a lot of pivots in your business. So, like, do you have any advice or, like, how to deal with setbacks or, like, deal with a very volatile market and kind of world we live in right now, right? How do you have success or even have the motivation as an artist when we live in the world that we do right now? Even though it's like filled with opportunity, it's also like filled with so much dread and like fears.
A lot of it boils down to your mindset and doing everything that you can to get yourself in the frame of mind and focus on what is going right or where the opportunities are. And I know that that sounds really simple, but I really think that that is, I mean, you wouldn't know all the challenges that I'm facing. You know, if you see my TikTok videos, you wouldn't know all the fires I'm putting out behind the scenes or what I'm waking up experiencing. I know that it feels really scary right now. My business started after September 11th. I've survived that, the market crash. I've survived having a divorce, you know, like divorce in my life. Like I've survived a lot of setbacks. This past year has been very difficult for a lot of manufacturers. The partners that I work with have had a very difficult year. So I've suffered a lot of setbacks and have been through a lot of like, I've been through the ups and downs. And so my first piece of advice would be to kind of like work on your mindset, because when you are, you can feel what you feel about things and have those fears and have those thoughts creep up. But if you act off of that mindset, you're never going to be able to get past your fear. Mm-hmm. So you can have those fears, you can release them and then count your blessings, you know, like count your blessings, like have gratitude, focus on what's going right. And like, when you get your head into that headspace, you can actually make decisions off of that. And actually, I want to give you good tangible example of something that happened when we were in the lockdown. You know, I was working with a coach and I'm a single mom, so I'm raising my kids. I'm in New York City and I didn't know whether to stay in New York because everybody was leaving. Everybody was moving back in with their families and like, you know, going to the suburbs and like
I'm decided.
Yeah. I mean, so I thought about it too. And so, you know, I drove to Greenwich, Connecticut and I'm like, you know, looking at houses and I didn't really know where I was worried about what was going to happen when the school year started. Would my kids be online at home? Would they be able to go to school? I didn't know how to make the decision because my kids were really happy in the city and that's all they've ever known. And that's all I've known as an adult in my life. And I couldn't picture myself in the suburbs, but I felt that that would have been a great place for us. And when I couldn't, I found myself like, I would find a house and I would go to sign the lease and I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. I would be able to breathe. And I couldn't reconcile why that was happening when it was so logical that I would move just where everybody else is going. It would have been so easy to just like sit on the beach and, you know, in the Connecticut than be in this city. So my coach boiled it down to when I kept kind of going through the process of making the decision, I was focusing on what I thought could happen that was bad. Mm-hmm. But she said, well, what decision would you make if everything went well? Like, imagine you got past this horrible time of lockdown and everything went really well for you. Where would you want to be? And then it became very easy for me to choose to stay in the city because if everything was going to go well, I wouldn't have gone anywhere.
Yeah.
So that's a good example of like, you don't see these like subtle things. Our minds have just really played tricks on us and make us believe all kinds of things that aren't true.
Especially as artists, like you're already in this, like, I don't know, I feel like as artists, you really battle with the darkness because the darkness is what fuels the art for most people, right? It's the happy emotions or the sad emotions. There is emotion behind art. So it's really easy to fall into those kind of cracks and crevices of just like despair and unknowingness of what's going to happen. But I the mindset thing is still, you're ever evolving. It's never fully complete or fully baked. And I'm sure you've lived more life than I have. So I'm sure you could say like, you could be as positive as possible in this chapter of life. And then something hits you and you're like, damn it. Like I'm down and out for the next year. Like, I mean, it happens. And then you're like, okay, let's pick back up again. Like
I spend a good portion of my time almost every morning mentally getting prepared to work and be productive and like supporting myself. You know, like and some people might say she's slow or she's never available or, you know, whatever. But I've made it. There were times where it had to be my full-time job to continue to stay in the day. And so, yeah, I've lived a lot longer and I don't know what I would do without the tools that I've had to develop out of necessity. The other thing that I think about is like, somebody created that cat, somebody created that cow, somebody created that fat chef. Like somebody was sitting there doing this and it became a thing. Like there are as crazy as the world is right now, it's also never been more creative. It's never been a better time.
It's amazing. Like every single thing that we use, we like everything has been created through someone's brain. Like,
yeah.
And nuts.
We all derive our pleasure from these little things, mm-hmm. you know? So sometimes I say to myself, like, do we really need more products in the world? Like, can I just stop doing this? Like, I don't need, but it's what it as a creative person, that's what fuels them. But then there are all kinds of other people that rely upon it too. Like, you know, you can't get pleasure out of the news, but you can get pleasure out of like stopping in a store and buying yourself like a new vase and putting some flowers in it, or, you know, just getting some new dishes or, you know, a new notebook that makes you happy that you like to look at on your desk. So, you know, we still need to live our lives. And that's part of how we do it and stay positive. So,
yeah, I mean, I've had complete life changes simply because I bought a desk that like brought me to tears because it was so beautiful. Like, it sounds so lame to say like, oh, it's material things that make us feel good. But we're also humans, we're Americans, we're consumers, but like art is fantastic. Like, I don't think art will ever go away. I know it's always like the one program that gets cut at school. It's the least funded, but it's like, it really is the thing that generates conversation that changes like the way, I don't know, even thinking about TV shows, Nickelodeon, like I don't know if you saw the whole quiet on set thing that's going on, the whole thing. I mean, I have been a blast from the past thinking about my entire childhood of like,
yeah,
that it was a stand up show that I watched. And now I love comedy and I'm on, do podcasts. Like I completely shaped who I am as a person. Like,
yeah,
that's what art does.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a real solid place for it. It's not frivolous. It's a very important part of our lives. And, you know, people also have a lot of fear about AI. And I get questions about that. I don't really know what's going to happen there, but I don't think AI has proven to replace like the human,
the human form,
in the process
never.
Yet. So
it, no.
I think that, you know, it's as scary as it is. And, you know, and like with anything, some people are going to be wildly successful and some people are going to have a harder time getting to that point. But some of the businesses and the brands that I think about today are things that are just 1,000,000% in somebody's mind's eye. And like there's a brand called Little Words Project and it's just like friendship bracelets, right? Like we all make friendship bracelets with
Isn't
those like letters.
Is Soho that we were talking about? Oh my God.
Yeah.
I've been talking to everyone about that, how that's nuts. How it's like literally just a string bracelet and they're making tons of money. Like
somebody built an entire brand and business off of that. And there's all kinds of licensing potential for that too. And like in and out and whatever. And it's like, when I first saw it and I remember buying it, I remember being in a store and seeing like something that said like, you know, I don't even know. It was like some kind of messages that I thought my kids would love them. And they were like $25. It was like not, it was like overpriced for what it was, but it gave them pleasure. It gave me pleasure to give it to them. And then lo and behold, it becomes this like thing. And it was just, it was somebody's idea to do this. It was somebody's idea to build an entire brand around something that we all do at the crafting table at home, or that we've all had, you know, just like that.
Yeah.
It's never been a better time to just build something off of your own creativity. And I haven't been in the job market in a really long time because I've had my own agency for over 2 decades now, but I don't hear good things about it. And I think more and more people are going to have to find a way to, you know, why not? I mean, let's say you and all your friends are kind of like, let's say you've got a friend who's amazing at maybe the business side of things and like, two of you are really good with art and another one's really good with logistics. Like, you know, not everybody has to employ themselves, team up and like start doing something together, like support each other and figure out how you guys are going to, you know, build your own thing. Like,
that's a
I just think more
idea.
And more people are going to do it. You know, I always wonder, like when people come to me for coaching services or they take like a licensing course and they apply it to themselves. But if you can learn something like this and you can apply it to yourself, then you can apply it and you can do what I do. You can apply it to all these others and you can make more money that way. Like use it, you like yep. build, you know, take what you've learned and build upon it. That is what everybody's doing. Whether it's like this digital course world, it's like you learn something from somebody's course and now you're going to teach everybody through the course that's based off the course you took. It's just pay it all forward. Let's do it all together. Like,
yeah.
Not everybody needs to sit in isolation and figure themselves out. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Really like that a lot. Also, the 9-to-5 model is changing because the world is changing and remote work. And like, yeah, I'm really curious to see how this next iteration of artists and creatives and workers kind of go about. But like, yeah, I you blew my mind this episode. I have so many like follow up questions, but I'm going to leave it at that as to not overwhelm listeners and stuff. I'll probably reach out to you privately because I myself am looking to get into art and stuff, like mm-hmm. licensing and whatever. But as we wrap this up again, so it's such a fruitful episode. Is there any like last piece of advice you could give to our audience? Maybe like, or even a version of advice you'd give your younger self who's pursuing artistry, business, licensing, anything that you feel called to share?
You know, I've touched upon a lot throughout this episode, this idea of working on your mindset, very mm-hmm. important, whether you are doing the artist's way or whether you just have like a journal or whether you do meditation or whether there's like a guru you follow like Gabby Bernstein or somebody like that, like just work on your mind every day and you know, absorb as much positivity as possible. It's amazing if you just put your mind in that place and make it a point to do it every single day, you won't have to seek it out anymore. It will just naturally become, and you'll be so much more productive and happier no matter what's happening. The second thing I also said was pay attention. Like if you are somebody who observes, just pay a lot of attention to what the brands that you admire, the artists that you are that are doing things that you want to do, even if it's people, influencers that are doing things that you want to do, if it's in the licensing and product space, or, you know, just like absorb, get into the stores, get familiar with what's happening at different retailers, and like draw some conclusions in your mind as you go through it. So absorb as much information as possible. The only other piece of advice that I have about maybe people who are starting out, and I think this kind of relates to still being in the corporate world, but like for me, my career got started on this path by choosing to go work for somebody that felt interesting and important to me. So I think, you know, sometimes I think we've all been, I think especially this younger generation, you may not never have to do that because you may be employing yourself your entire life, which is incredible. But if you aren't in that position or you don't want to be in that position, there is something to be said by being an assistant to the most important person you could possibly find.
Oh, for sure.
That will have you, because you will learn so much and gain so many connections. And if I think if I had gone for, there were definitely opportunities for me to work in production as a coordinator of Me choosing to connect myself with one of the most influential people that wanted to hire me put me in a totally different stratosphere. And so that's another piece of advice that I have.
Honestly, people give a lot of shit for assistants. Like, oh, you're an assistant. Oh, I was an assistant on Wall Street too for years, and it completely changed my career. It put me in rooms I would never be able to be in if I had a different title as like an analyst or this or that. Like, honestly, I loved being an assistant. I really did.
Me
it was
too.
Phenomenal. I got to play. It. Like, every day was different. But anyway, that's a whole nother conversation.
I had a deal with my boss that she would promote me within a year. But honestly, within that year, I would have stayed if she had said, I want to keep you here because I love that job.
Yeah. So you learned so much. So much exposure.
I learned so much. And I loved it. She would send me to buy baby gifts for like, you know, presidents of other companies.
Like tasks you'd go out and do. It's honestly the best. Yeah,
I loved it.
I would have stayed if the corporate model didn't kill me. But, you know, it's
same.
It is what it is.
Same.
But this has been phenomenal. I'm so excited. I'm literally after this, I'm going to call like my boyfriend. He's going to be on break. I'm going to call him and be like, guess who I talked to? We've both been like, he's like, you need to tell me all the things about Julie because he's an artist as well. So I got a lot of value. I know my audience is going to love this. But and everyone listening, all of Julie's stuff is going to be in the show notes, where to find her if you want to book a strategy session with her, anything like that, be in her world. It's going to be there. But anything you want to add before we wrap up? Or
I share a lot of information I share as much as I can on TikTok. Like I share as much as I have time to do on TikTok. And there's a lot of info in there if you go through my videos, and that's it.
Great videos too. That's how I found you. Very, very informational.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. I love doing this. I actually feel like service is such an important part of life. So, you know, So I'm here to share information. I'm really glad that you decided to reach out to me. And, you know, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Yeah, of course. And I'm definitely going to be in touch. So just I'll be coming. Yeah. So thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thank you.